Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is on-the-ground fighting really like in Afghanistan? And how did a small team of Special Forces soldiers manage to regain control over a critical Taliban stronghold despite being vastly outnumbered by enemy combatants? In 2006, Major Rusty Bradley was serving his third tour of duty in Afghanistan, having enlisted in the Army after college in 1993 and completed officer candidate school in 1999. On this tour, Bradley was given command of an Army Special Forces A-team in Kandahar province and assigned to divert enemy resources from a large NATO offensive known as Operation Medusa. The battle went on for weeks, and Major Bradley shares his account of what he and his men endured and achieved in a new book written with journalist Kevin Moore. It's called Lions of Kandahar, the story of a fight against all odds. Rusty, welcome to Think.
How are you, Chris? Thank you for having me.
Very well. It's great to have you on the program. So, as I mentioned in the introduction, your team was assigned as a diversionary element to assist this larger NATO initiative in Kandahar. What does that mean, to act as a diversion?
Okay, essentially what happened was when we rotate in, we usually fall in on whatever supporting forces are already in theater. It just so happened that after we had rotated in, it had been discovered that there was a large number of Taliban and foreign insurgent fighters that had moved into a valley about 40 kilometers west of Kandahar.
Mm-hmm.
ISAF, which is the International Security Assistance Forces, had put together a pretty significant operation to go in and clear those Taliban out, because their intent was to try to move into Kandahar City and throw it essentially into chaos and disrupt what we were doing, not just militarily but internationally.
And they had in this area all kinds of places to hide. There were irrigation ditches, very, very tall marijuana fields.
Oh, yes, ma'am, and that's just inside the valley. I mean, if you could really imagine a labyrinth, the valley and most of the places in Afghanistan, if you go into a typical village, they are a labyrinth,
mm-hmm,
of mud huts and buildings and alleyways intersected by deep irrigation ditches, high trees, again, tall mud buildings. There's no real graphic representation that we as Westerners understand for, you know, streets and corners. So once you get in there, you're really almost trapped to whatever sort of geographic terrain is inside that valley. And it was extremely difficult to maneuver and to operate in a place that really has no standard to it whatsoever, other than if you own a piece of property, you just build it there.
Yeah. Now, this was not unfamiliar country to you. You'd been deployed to Afghanistan twice before this mission we're talking about and twice since. Talk about the sort of preparation you would do ahead of each deployment to understand what you were likely to encounter.
Well, that's a pretty big question. Typically, at this point in my deployments, I just got back about a month ago from my fifth deployment, but we, at that time, were operating almost back-to-back, so we would deploy for 6 or 7 months into theater and then come back. And essentially what you do is you come home and you reaccount for all your property, you put in for all kinds of replacement equipment, and then you go into about 90 days of very intensive training to prepare for the next deployment. So it's pretty much back-to-back, and you have, in Special Forces, you are really the utility tool to the military, whereas, you know, some people are more of, we equate things to tools where, you know, if you're in the Ranger Regiment or if you're in the infantry and the airborne, you're kind of a hammer. And if you're, a very secret organization like, those that work above us, then you're more of a scalpel. Our job is, because we have to be able to do a lot of different missions on a regular basis, we're kind of a utility tool. So what we do is we train on, you know, unconventional warfare, working with indigenous forces, learning the languages. We train on foreign internal defense. We train on the weapon systems they're going to use. We train on culture. We really focus on what the people of this area or this region how they live and how they conduct themselves and their customs and courtesies in order to integrate with them, because we typically live within the forces and the people, the populations that we're working with.
I want to talk about those relationships some more. There's one instance in the book where an elderly man comes up to you and you're not quite sure what to expect, and he looks as if he might sympathize, in fact, with the Taliban, and he gives you the equivalent of what would have been 2 weeks of work in terms of intelligence by your team.
That was one of many very surreal moments, I think, that I've experienced in about 5 years worth of rotations in Afghanistan. The Afghani people, for the most part, understand the difference, in my opinion, between good and evil. They know that we're there to try to help them. They see how the Taliban and the foreign fighters and the other terrorist groups that are there, how they operate. And, you know, it's to tell you the truth, it's not uncommon for somebody just to come up on the street and say, hey, those two guys over in that building watching you from a doorway, they're the guys that are putting the IEDs in. And that sort of thing happens, you know, again, pretty regularly, but I think it's indicative of the fact that the Afghan people are trying their very best to help us help them.
So you speak some Pashto, and the indigenous forces, as you mentioned, the Afghan troops that you were working with occasionally speak some English. How good does the communication tend to be from one army to the other?
That's a great question. There are, you know, hand and arm signals that sort of cross all language barriers. We do spend a tremendous amount of time trying to learn languages of whatever host nation that we're in. In particular, Afghanistan is an extremely tribal place that is, for all accounts, what we consider ancient. Mm-hmm. The dialects of the tribal languages that they speak may be centuries or more older, and they're very diverse. So for me to, you know, try to beat my chest and tell you that I fluently speak that language would be foolish. But, you know, you, after time working with the same people in the same tribes, you do start to pick up the dialects. And it was key to be able to have them, to be able to speak to them, you know, as closely as they understand it. And you can cross those, not just those language barriers, but those professional and personal barriers where they understand inherently that you are trying to help them and you're trying to learn their language and be courteous. And they really respect that. And that emulates back across where they're trying to learn English. They're trying to learn enough professionally so that you can communicate together. And I think for the most part, you may not be able to carry on a conversation about, you know, ordering a wine or talking, you know, extensive politics. But in as far as normal operations, it's something that we've gotten pretty decent at. And, of course, we do have interpreters and stuff for more detailed discussions, but it's really pivotal to be able to communicate, and I think we're getting to the point where our militaries and our governments are working together enough that we're really educating each other, and that's significant.
We've heard a lot over the years, Rusty, about the challenges of working with the Afghan Army, in part because so few of its members have had much of any formal education. A lot of them are illiterate. How do you deal with things like that when you can't sort of hand them a manual, even written in their own language, and say, spend an hour, look this over, and we'll talk about what it contains?
the Afghans are a truly unique people, a unique collection of tribes. A lot of what we try to focus on doing with the Afghans is education. Most of the Afghans, for a significant part, because they're a survivalistic society of people, they can speak usually about four languages, but they only have a third grade education. So a lot of what we try to do, especially at my level, was we would bring in, when we were training Afghans, we would not only try to train them militarily and professionally as soldiers, but we also try to bring in teachers to teach them Pashtun so they can learn to read and write, you know, learn their own alphabet, learn their own, how to sign their own name, which is, you know, almost the ability to teach a grown man who's a been a fighter his whole life, and to give him the pride and the self-respect to be able to sign his own name really can't be measured. And a lot of that is symbiotic, because they're also teaching, you know, we're teaching them literal Pashtun, you know, in an educated forum, but we're also trying to teach them English as well. So we're educating them as well as training them, and that that really has been empowering to them, because they've never gotten that from any country that's ever been there. And it's, you know, it adds to your workload and it adds to your time, but what it benefits you in the long run, not just as in creating a more professional military and police force, but in creating international partners and friendships is pretty vast.
You know, Rusty, listening to you tell these stories already in this hour, I'm hearing this extraordinary sensitivity and respect for people with whom on the surface you might not seem to have anything in common, and for whom you are regularly risking your life. Is this a change in the modern Army that maybe didn't exist even to this degree in 1993 when you started?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it depends on what your job is in the military. I mean, when you're in the infantry, or you're in a, you know, when you're in a strike force type unit, your job is not to go in there and make friends.
Yeah.
You know, when the president says go in there and destroy this overnight, that's what your job is. Inherently in special forces, you know, we focus on doing population-centric operations. We work by, with, and through the indigenous people and the armies and the governments that are there. And I think, I don't know, when you know what your mission statements are, and for us, we're not only trying to, help the government of Afghanistan get rid of the insurgency, but we're also trying to help them build a country. And in doing that, you have to build relationships with these people, because they're putting they're really putting their lives, the lives of their families, they're putting their future in your hands. And you have to, once you step back from that and you realize that they're essentially sacrificing everything to take that one chance, that one shot at freedom, and they're putting it all in your hands, it's a huge responsibility, and you get the opportunity to step back and not look at things, you know, with blinders on, and you kind of look at the whole perspective of what not just the people of Afghanistan are doing, but the soldiers and the policemen and the government officials. They've really not ever known what peace is, and in order to help them build a country that they can govern themselves without outside influence from Iran or Pakistan, and to be able to run their own country and govern themselves is something that is really resonating with them. And I think that, you know, let me give you a prime example if you've got a second.
Sure.
One of the Mujahideen are considered religious freedom fighters, and against the war with the Soviets, most of the fighters, pretty much anybody who fought against the Soviet, against the Russians, considered themselves Mujahideen fighters. And you essentially had two groups. You had the foreign fighters, the jihadists that came in from, you know, all the other countries in the world that, you know, the vast majority of them ended up falling under Al-Qaeda or the Haqqani network.
You know, let me stop you. You've set that up so far. We're going to take a quick break, and I want to make sure you have time to tell the whole story. So let me stop you right there. My guest is Major Rusty Bradley. He was commander of an Army Special Forces A-team in Spirwan Gar on his third tour of duty in Afghanistan, which is the subject of his new book, Lions of Kandahar, The Story of a Fight Against All Odds. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is U.S. Army Special Forces Major Rusty Bradley. His new book, written with journalist Kevin Moorer, is called Lions of Kandahar, the story of a fight against all odds. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Rusty, just before the break, you were telling us about the Mujahideen dating back to the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Essentially, there were two types of fighters during that period of time. One were the foreign fighters, and obviously one were the inherent Afghan that lived there and had taken up arms against the Russian occupation. The Mujahideen leaders, the Afghan leaders who fought against the Soviets, are absolutely revered in their culture. They're, you know, it, really living beyond the age of about 45 or 50 is phenomenal because of a myriad of physical reasons. But a lot of the leaders that are that still remain who fought against the Soviets are so highly viewed by the people and the tribes that are there, it really crosses a lot of boundaries that you find that make Afghanistan diverse. Well, the reason I say that is because one of the things we're really starting to see across the board that, has having an impact on the Afghan people is the Mujahideen fighters are coming to us, these old leaders who can really, you know, at the snap of fingers can have 100, 200 young men follow them and do anything. They're coming to us now and saying, you know, we want to be leaders of the Afghan future. We would like to hold some sort of political office or be able to advise and participate in some capacity. And to be able to sit and talk with a Mujahideen leader who has so much effect on the Afghan people, and to have them sit there and look at you and laugh when, you know, when they hear, because they do have radios and they hear about the international news and the propaganda that goes on from the countries all around them, and they kind of one leader, I don't want to mention his name in particular, but he laughed because he and I were having a chai discussion, and he said, you know, the rest of the world seems to think that you are you know, here to occupy us. And he said, that's really what the Taliban are trying to tell people over in Pakistan. And he said, I will tell you, as a true Mujahideen leader who fought against the Soviets, I know what jihad is. And he said, you're here to help us. So he said, if you want my support, he said, I'll be glad to help you. And he said, you know, these insurgents that are coming, that these young Taliban that are coming in here that are getting, you know, a lot of ideological poison from, you know, across the border, and he was implying Pakistan. He said, these people don't represent Afghanistan. He said, you know, we represent Afghanistan. He said, we know that you're here to help us. And that really, you know, you can't have a stronger voice when you sit down in a shura. An shura is, you know, a local tribal meeting where you have all the elders and maliks and representatives from all the villages come in and sit down at your firebase or at a local community location. And when those guys sit and say, look, the Americans are here to help us, it's really inspiring is what it really is, because you know that you're reaching the people that could be the difference between, you know, success or failure, and their ability to emulate what we're trying to do because they get it. They know what the real difference is between a religious war and one where people are simply trying to keep it unstable because they want their power back.
So what made Spirwan Gar, which looks in photographs like a very, like sort of like a mountain covered with sand, what made this such a critical target to retake possession of? Because my understanding is that Allied troops had it and then sort of lost it during the time that you were away, and then you were back to take it again.
Well, pretty much the entire province had been under a pretty sound security posture when we had left in 2006, and then had happened is that essentially the Taliban had reorganized and had decided to come back and try to take over parts of Kandahar City, and in doing that, they collected all their fighters and resources in this valley west of Kandahar City, and it's in two small districts, which would be the equivalent of two counties. Mm-hmm. But Panjwai was the birthplace of the Taliban. It is where Mullah Omar essentially proclaimed himself the supreme leader of the Taliban. Tremendous amount of the Taliban senior leadership owned property there. So it's really, it's their heart and soul. It's their epicenter. And this is where they had collected for this large fight. And essentially what had been put together was ISAF, which is the International Security Assistance Forces. They have control of southern Afghanistan militarily for the coalition. It had been discovered that these fighters were in there. The original estimates were a couple of hundred, maybe 200 to 300, which is still a large number of enemy fighters.
Sure.
ISAF had put together an operation called Medusa. And the intent behind Medusa was that they would go into these areas and clear out, engage and destroy and drive out the enemy before they could get into Kandahar City. Our job at that time was as what we call a supporting effort. Our job was to go in and do reconnaissance and probe these positions and try to find out where the enemy were and to report all this information back, and then to establish some blocking positions, which are just military positions south of where this operation was supposed to take place in order to prevent the enemy from escaping. After about 2 days into the battle, what was quickly determined was that at this time the enemy had become more equipped, were in larger numbers than anybody had ever imagined. And when ISAF went in to assault their first objective, they were stopped very quickly. And the significance of Spirwan Gar is that it was a small little hill, which is nothing more than a 60-foot-tall dirt mound that sort of protruded from the center of the valley. And after 2 days of listening to ISAF taking pretty significant casualties on the radio, I turned to my commander at the time, Jared Hill, and said, you know, we need to take a hard look at getting up there on top of that high ground, because what it did was it offered us observation down into the valley where ISAF was fighting.
Sure.
And if we could get up there on top of that hill, we could take and provide air cover from the coalition aircraft and the U.S. Air Force to be able to support their operation, which at that time was not available. So we put together a very hasty plan and decided that we were going to move forward and occupy Spirwan Gar. And what we didn't realize at the time was the complexity of the enemy plan and what Spirwan Gar actually was, which was a Taliban training camp and a command and control center for all the forces that were in the Panjwai Valley. So we really we drove right into the middle of a hornet's nest.
So this ends up taking weeks to achieve this objective. It sounds like one of the hardest things you've ever encountered. When you are in a situation where it is dangerous and uncomfortable and hard all the time, there are small things that you do to take comfort and find a sense of, even if it's somewhat false, safety. Can you tell us about Old Girl?
I wish I still had that truck. It was a first generation Humvee. It was one of the first vehicles that gone over there. It was pretty much unarmored. It was designed as a all-terrain scout reconnaissance vehicle. It's a what most people recognize as a Humvee,
mm-hmm.
And it was painted gray, and it was really almost a safety blanket, because from that vehicle, every time I got into it, it was my communications platform. It was a all those vehicles back then, and even today still are, were massive fire support platforms where they really bristled with weapons. And it's funny because the enemy, even today on the radio, they call them porcupines because they've got so many weapons sticking out of them that they look like a porcupine down in the valley. But to be able to sit down in that truck and to know the power that it possessed, and within it, you know, the soldiers that were in it were some of the best trained, best equipped, most motivated and loyal men that, you know, the U.S. military can put together, this country can provide to protect it. It really makes me kind of nostalgic to think about it, because I had a lot of history with that vehicle. I mean, I had been with that vehicle for several years. There was even when we had been in a firefight a couple of years previous, my team sergeant had been shot while we were doing some operations over near the border, and a round had missed going through the windshield and hitting me. And I had ridden something that I won't say on the radio on the hood, but they, you know, the whoever had fired the round had missed me. And just getting inside the vehicle was really a comfort, because I had, you know, I just had a real sense of patriotism, because I knew that my country had supplied me with, you know, the exact type of equipment that I needed. And then, you know, when we were getting ready, back then when we were getting ready to go into an area, we would unfurl Afghan flags and American flags and, you know, fly them from the tops of the trucks so that the enemy could see us coming. When we wanted them to know who they were up against. And it was, it was a pretty unique piece of equipment. I would have brought it home if they would have let me and put it in a museum.
At multiple times in the events you describe in this book, Rusty, the fighting goes on for hours and hours and hours, 13, 14, 15 hours. Obviously, you're exhausted. Your men are exhausted. Is that exhaustion enough to help you sleep when you can? Or is that a skill to learn how to let your body and your mind relax to the extent that you can get a few hours of sleep in one of the most dangerous places in the world?
Well, I mean, I think in some part it goes back to training. You know, when you go to schools like Ranger School, they teach you to operate off, you know, very minimal amounts of sleep. You might get only 30 minutes at a time, you know, once or twice a day, or you might get 4 or 5 hours. You become very methodical in what you have to do, and your mind really stays switched on, so you don't get the opportunity to physically get rest that you think a normal person would get from, you know, sleeping in a comfortable, safe place for 6-7 hours at a time. It's really just something that you learn, and you don't really get to the point of where you get REM sleep and your body's actually relaxed. You just get enough sleep so that you can, you know, you're metabolic rate can recover, and you can get rehydrated, and your muscles get the opportunity to get some sort of rehydration, and then you're right back into it. But I think mentally you learn and are trained to the point where you don't switch off. You just shut down to a moderate level for a short period of time until you need to be awake again. It's really kind of hard to describe. I mean, there's times when you just, When it's safe enough that you can collapse, then you just sort of collapse, and then you wake right back up, and you're expected to go right back into the same mode you were in before you went to sleep.
One of the miracles of modern warfare and technology is that soldiers now occasionally have the ability to call home even from front lines. What did it take to sort of shift what you were thinking about and how you were speaking to speak to your wife and your child on the phone?
I knew I hadn't called in a while. The time that I, in that chapter in the book, I think in some part I knew that this was getting ready to turn in a direction that we hadn't expected it to. And that's not really something you know, a lot of times you want to put in print for your family and everybody else to see, but I wanted to check in and let them know that I was safe. You know, when you've been married in the military for a while, even if you're gone, you try to come up with some means of communication to, you know, let them know that you're okay. And I think the problem was that there were a lot of indicators that I think were probably out there, you know, the battle was on the international news at this time, and this was an area where I worked, and I just wanted to sort of send that little communication home that everything was okay. And you know, maybe in some part it was for me too. I wanted to hear those voices, because the truth is you really know when you're going to hear them for the last time.
And then when you're the guy in charge, what does it take to have the energy to keep everyone else positive and on task?
It's just, I don't know. This is, I think that's part of the mystique of the men that I serve with, and what they recruit you and train you and equip you and operationalize you to do. It's a sense of responsibility that, when you're working, there's such a small unit dynamic when you're working day in and day out with a small group of people, that you just overwhelmingly feel the responsibility to the people around you every single day. I mean, even to the point where, as a commander, I would have much rather been hurt myself than have one of my men hurt. I think that's, you know, a commander's responsibility is to be out front, not sitting in the back. And the soldiers that I don't want to say my soldiers are not my soldiers, they're the Army soldiers, but I took and still take a great amount of pride in the men that I was given the privilege to serve with, and I just really couldn't fathom anything happening to them, which is one of the reasons why you don't really sleep, because your mind is constantly... You're checking and rechecking yourself and second guessing, you know, to try to make sure that everything you put out there and everything you do is rock solid, and you get, you know, participation from the team members. We used to joke that, you know, there's 12 men on the SF team and the only bad idea is the captain's. But at the end of the day, that was one of the things that inherently made us, what I felt like at the time was almost unbreakable, was because before I made a command decision, I brought all my guys in together and said, you know, what's the best way to do this? Because I'm surrounded by experts on this team. My job
I'm
is to lead them.
Jump in one more time. Major Rusty Bradley is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Lions of Kandahar, The Story of a Fight Against All Odds.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Army Major Rusty Bradley. He was commander of a Special Forces A-team in Spirwan Gar on his third tour of duty in Afghanistan. It's the subject of his new book, Lions of Kandahar, The Story of a Fight Against All Odds. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Rusty, for those of us who have never been to war, I think we can at least on an intellectual level understand having to deal with the enemy trying to kill you. You also write here, almost like another character in the book, about the heat trying to kill you, or at least make your job nearly impossible to do. Can you talk a little bit about the effects of the heat on your body, on your skin?
It's absolutely sweltering. As hot as that, you know, I would think it would be in a place like the Mojave Desert or in on a ranch in Texas. It's the only way to describe it, I think, is if you were to point a hairdryer in your face all day long and try to operate, you know, conduct your normal life with that hairdryer in your face. It's just it grinds you down. Plus the terrain there, the sand and the dust gets, you know, it permeates everything, every piece of equipment, and it's just almost inconceivable how, when you're exposed to it day in and day out without normal hygiene, it doesn't just wear down your equipment. It wears you down physically and mentally, and it feels like you're baking in an oven all day long. And the after effects are just things that you have to deal with. You have to worry about, you know, cellulitis and infections and heat rash and even light blindness and deteriorated equipment when you're trying to make communications and you have things that are melting. I mean, literally, I remember as a kid watching war movies about being in armored units being in Africa and breaking an egg and putting it on a piece of metal and watching it fry. I mean, that's absolutely true. That's what it's like over there, and trying to operate in that kind of heat, you just really sort of pray for the day to be over so the sun goes down.
You have multiple accounts of people that you worked with doing really noble things for the sake of comrades. But talk about what happened when two of your men were in a vehicle that was attacked in a place where they were far away from any sort of cover for people who would go and rescue them.
Okay. That's something that I wrote about, and I really kind of didn't think about a lot. Essentially, in the middle of our second attack, trying to take the hill, known as Spear Wongar, we were clearing out. There's a small schoolhouse there, and we were clearing out the schoolhouse for the second time because some enemy had gotten intermingled with some of our people, and we had to re-clear it. Well, while we were re-clearing it, I called one of my trucks to come forward to provide support, and four trucks had already been over that little piece of roadway. And it just so happened that the fourth truck that went over hit an IED, an improvised explosive device. And I tried to call the commander immediately because I thought that it was him that had been hit, and there was no response. And I went racing back to where the vehicle was, and knowing that we had just taken on what was a triple basic load of ammunition. That's three times the amount of ammunition that we already carry. And when I got to the scene, or when I got to where the vehicle had struck, it had blown the vehicle up, the entire vehicle up into the air, and moved it about 15 feet off the road. And it was just, the entire area was covered with pitch black smoke. And one of my commo sergeants, Jude, was in the process of trying to rescue a soldier while on the vehicle, while the vehicle was still burning and exploding. And that was really the moment that I knew that I had walked with some real life heroes.
You say you wrote about it without thinking about it. Do you mean that it's hard to even repeat it to talk about it?
Oh yes, ma'am, absolutely. I mean, there's certain things that you just, that was one of those defining moments, as I spoke about earlier, where you never want your men to be wounded or injured. And the first thing that I thought of when I initially heard and saw the explosion was that my guys were dead. And I crested about a 20-foot-tall berm just in time to see Jude pulling Greg off the vehicle and trying to get him help move to safety, which safety was nothing more than an irrigation ditch about 15 or 20 feet away, while this vehicle is obviously burning because and exploding. Mm-hmm. And then for him to have the presence of mind to sprint across an open field under heavy machine gun fire in absolute disregard for his own safety, to try to rescue an injured comrade was, I mean, your brain shuts down and you just, I think you just go into, a very methodical mode where you're trying to control your emotions, you're trying to do what needs to be done and maintain the momentum of battle. And what was significant about when Jude rescued Greg was that, number one, he rescued this guy from a scene that should have killed him. Mm-hmm. And then he managed to tell me that he couldn't find another soldier, which sent me crawling on my hands and knees looking for him, allowed me to find him and drag this other guy back to safety. So now he saved two people. And now that I know that these two people are alive, we can carry on the momentum of the fight once we can get them medical care versus, you know, really having to stop and in the middle of a pretty horrific firefight and try to determine, you know, where my wounded people are or how many I have killed. And for him to be able to do that as a young staff sergeant, his first rotation with the team, was phenomenal, not to mention the fact that he had, you know, when I got to him, the scene was bad enough with Greg's injuries, but Jude had burns on his face, burns on his hands, you know, some of his equipment was melted, and it was just the fact that his dedication to his fellow soldiers and his commitment to what he was doing was so great that he was willing to risk everything to save a wounded comrade.
I was struck by the fact in reading that account, Rusty, that perhaps for the benefit of everybody else but themselves, they're also still using humor to sort of let people know that things are okay.
You know, I think after a period of time, you, in these instances, you really kind of build up almost a morbid sense of humor where, you know, I use the example of after we managed to get the wounded to the what we call the casualty collection point, we got them away from the situation where they were really being engaged by enemy fire near this vehicle that was still continuing to burn and explode. And then, you know, my team sergeant, Sergeant First Class Bill Brown, was able to link up with me, get the soldiers over to a place where they could be given medical treatment, some semblance of medical treatment, and get them medevaced, and then to meet me back up on top of the hill and just sort of almost take a breath in the middle of a firefight. And, you know, Bill said, these jokers just don't ever give up, and, you know, we're probably not going to make it today. And just to be able to look at him and laugh and say, well, you know, you're not dead yet, so, you know, get your butt back to work. That's almost a sense of humor that you can really only understand sometimes, I think, from the inside looking out. But it's a defensive mechanism. It's, you know, you have close calls, and I've found myself just laughing hysterically when you know, you find bullet holes in your uniform where, you know, if it would have been 2 or 3 inches either way, you would have been, you know, badly injured. So.
And there was one point at which your life was essentially saved by the fact that your body armor had malfunctioned.
That was right after I'd gotten wounded. And luckily, I think you're talking about the case where I had an RPG round go off beside me, blow me in a ditch. Mm-hmm. I was pretty much incoherent, and my body armor had shifted and was cockeyed, and I was trying to crawl back to my truck, and some sort of weapon system. I'd gotten shot in the back, and if the body armor had not been cockeyed, the bullet would have gone all the way through me, but it didn't, and it hit the plate, and I refuse to believe that it's really anything more than divine intervention. It just wasn't my day.
Hmm. Was it hard to write this book, Rusty, knowing that your wife would read it, your mom would read it, and all the things that maybe you've tried not to share with them would be there in black and white?
It was, but I think I had to accept the fact that it was more important for me to be able to tell the story and have the American people understand the significance not only of what the battle meant then, but how important the area is now. You know, the families are the building blocks that allow us to return to our lives between trips, you know, lives that keep us motivated when we're away. And I do think that overall our families have made the most difficult sacrifices because deployments limit the number of anniversaries and birthdays and holidays that you can be present for. But, you know, even more significantly, when a soldier deploys, he knows where he's at. The family doesn't. And to me, that makes the burden tougher to bear. So, you know, I really have to salute those who are left behind to, you know, sacrifice and silence while their loved ones are away. But it was more important for me professionally and personally, you know, as the ground assault commander, to be able to tell readers about the events depicted in the book, and to let people know that this is a prime example of what America can do when it sets its jaw and refuses to bow its back. You know, the book's not about failure or sheer escape. It's about victory and absolute defiance of the odds and in the face of an overwhelming enemy. And, you know, nothing will ever change the fact that 5 years after the day that we were attacked, we stood on top of what was an enemy training camp and you know, celebrated September 11th in the face of what should have been, you know, a defeat, and it wasn't. And we, you know, we did that with, you know, our Canadian counterpart and our Afghan partners and, you know, my soldiers and the other teams that were there with us. There were two other teams that contributed. It wasn't just, I mean, we all fought. We all contributed. If it wouldn't have been for each other, this was probably the greatest example of teamwork that you'll ever find.
Where were you when you heard that Osama bin Laden was dead?
I was in a small room doing some planning.
and what sort of? I mean, was it a physical reaction, or how did that news strike you?
It was. I would have to honestly tell you that it was a great sense of relief. I mean, I won't use the words that I used then, but I think it's, you know, a lot of us had been hoping for the opportunity to be able to be a part of a mission like that. That was the real intent for us going there 10 years ago. And I think what's significant about it is, you know, with his death, yes, it's a great victory in what's been America's longest war, but there's many more struggles to be won. You know, the Taliban are pushing into a pretty fierce offensive this summer because they're getting tired of fighting, and they're really throwing a lot of all they have left into this summer. And, you know, it could be a turning point. The key battles in southern Afghanistan this summer will be fought on the same battlefields we fought in the book, and in some way the outcome of the war may, you know, well be decided in the South. But we've made significant gains. While much of this progress is fragile at best, you know, we're positioned to expand and vigorously defend it, you know, with our Afghan allies. And hopefully by the end of summer, Afghanistan will be firmly on the path towards progress and peace.
The new book by Army Major Rusty Bradley is called Lions of Kandahar, the story of a fight against all odds. Rusty, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for your service to the country.
Thank you, Ms. Boyd, and please let your listeners know, thank you for being a country worth fighting for.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.